I'd like to begin with a quote. This is a session on the history of Jewish-Christian relationships. This is from Edwin Flannery. I wrote the first name, I can't quite read in my, I think it's Edwin Flannery, a Roman Catholic, who wrote a book called The Anguish of the Jews. And this, what is in this quote is really what we'll be looking at tonight. He said, the pages that Christians have torn out of their history books are the pages Jews know by heart. The pages that Christians have torn out of their history books are the pages the Jews know by heart. This really came home to me several years ago. I think it was the anniversary of something in Lutherland or the Augsburg Confession. Prime Minister Begin in Israel, I read it in Newsweek or Time, but made the announcement, a reminder to Lutherans of the quotes and things that Martin Luther had said about Jews and how they contributed to the Holocaust. Now, 99% of Lutherans don't know what Martin Luther said about Jews that contributed very definitely to the Holocaust. But the fact that Prime Minister Begin knew what Martin Luther had said, I think is an indication that maybe almost every Jew knows what Martin Luther said. I think that's one little example of what this quote, the pages we have torn out of our history books are the pages that the Jews know by heart. And not only in Jewish-Christian relationships, but just in the simple basics of Jewish history. We tend to know Jewish history from Abraham until Christ, don't we? And then after Christ, or after the early church, then we drop out. And how many of us even know the name of one famous Jewish person from the year 100 to the 20th century? We know so little, and I'd like to just fill in a little tonight and then have some sharing on that. What I'll do is both just trace the history of the relationships of Jews and Christians through the centuries, and what we'll do is we'll rush through 20 centuries in about a half hour. And then try to talk then about what possibly this could mean to us as Christians today. But just a brief review of where Jewish history, some of the most exciting time of Jewish history, is the very point at which we blank out. And we could start this way, that at the time of Jesus, there were really two schools of thought in Palestine. And one was led by one rabbi, another led by another rabbi. Hillel was the liberal, according to the way we tend to use that word. Shammai, the conservative. And each side struggled to dominate. And we have examples in the Gospels. For example, when they came and asked Jesus about his opinion on marriage and divorce, they were really trying to get Jesus to take either the Hillel side or the Shammai side of that question, to try to pull Jesus on one of the two sides. Well, the Hillel position prevailed, and then the rabbinic Judaism that you had after the time of Jesus was really in the tradition of the Hillel, who had an interpretation of the law which we would say was much more adaptable to the changing life. Now, the great disaster to happen to Judaism in the first century was 70 AD, the fall of Jerusalem. And we have to think now, when the Roman armies surrounded Jerusalem and then finally defeated the Jewish armies, and the Roman army swept over the walls, what this meant to Judaism as a community of faith. The Romans did this. They leveled the city of Jerusalem to the ground. and they left only one wall standing, and the purpose of leaving that one wall standing was to show the world how powerful of a city this had been. And what is that wall today? The Wailing Wall, the one wall that was left standing when the armies of Rome devastated the city of Jerusalem. Now, what they devastated was 1,000 years of temple religion, 1,000 years of the Jewish people and their religion centering in the sacrificial system in the temple. And now what does the people do when it's been torn away? The city is ruined, the temple is ruined, most of them have been carried off to Rome and other places as slaves. Some are left behind. There was one rabbi now that was left behind, a disciple of Hillel. His name was Johanan ben Zakkai, or Jack. You see how unfamiliar we are with these names? Z-A-K-K-A-I. Can you help me pronounce that? Okay. Zakkai. Now, he established a school on the coast of the Mediterranean, and he got permission from the Roman emperor to do this, and it was at Jamnia. And now, just as during the Babylonian captivity, when a tremendous surge of Jewish creativity happened, now at Jamnia, the same thing happens in the midst of disaster. The Jewish people, under their rabbis at Jamnia, do things like this. They organize, they reorganize Jewish life. They set the calendar. They define now what will be the Jewish liturgy, which now will center not in the temple, but in the synagogues. The council then at Jamnia sets the Hebrew scriptures, our Old Testament, that we call the Old Testament. The books for the Old Testament were not set until Jamnia set them. And as Christians, we accept the decision of Jamnia as what is the scripture. And they also began what was called the Talmud and is still called the Talmud. First of all, do you remember, what is the Torah? What is the Torah?
The Pentateuch.
Right. The five books, Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, Deuteronomy. Now the Talmud is the traditions of the great teachers interpreting the Torah for daily life. And so now the great scholars at Jamnia start writing down the interpretations. And notice now when the community has gone through this disaster, then it becomes important now to begin writing down the traditions that they may be kept. Now another thing that happened at a great council at Jamnia in 90 AD, which is critical now for Jewish-Christian relationships. Up until this time, if you were a Christian Jew, you were still a member of the synagogue after 70. In other words, you would go to synagogue to worship with the Jews, and then you would go to the Eucharist, maybe on Saturday night, to worship with the Christians, but you were still a member of the synagogue. In 90 AD, because of the increasing tension over the argument about if Jesus was the Messiah or not, all Jews who believed in Jesus were excommunicated from the synagogue. Now, this had many more implications for Jewish people in the Jewish Christians in the Roman Empire than just the fact now they were excommunicated from the synagogue, but the Jewish people had what was called a concordate worked out with the Roman government that Jews did not have to worship the emperor. And now when Christian Jews were excommunicated, now they were no longer under this protection, and therefore they were open now to the persecution of the Roman Empire. Jews were also persecuted by Rome. In the year 132 was a great persecution of the Emperor of Hadrian, and he built now a pagan temple on top of the ruins where the Jewish temple had once been. And like I said, there was a terrible persecution of Jewish people. And during this persecution, one of the great martyrs and the great, what we would call saints of Judaism, the one that really held the people together at this time and was killed by the Romans at this time, and his name was Rabbi Akiba. Have you heard the name? Rabbi Akiba. I'm familiar with this name because in Albuquerque, a Jewish school rented our Sunday school building during the week and used our rooms, and it was called the Akiba School. So we had a sign in front of our church, St. Paul Lutheran Church, Akiba School, underneath. After this persecution in 138, the center of Judaism on Palestine moves to Galilee. Now, think how familiar the Sea of Galilee, all the stories of Jesus. Now here the great scholars, and if you read Mitchner's source, he has stories about the rabbis that gather at Galilee. And there they continue this great work of systematizing the traditions of the fathers and the teachers into the Talmud. And if we had a long time to explain, there developed a Palestinian Talmud, and there were still people in Babylonia that were also developing a Talmud. So there became a Palestinian and a Babylonian Talmud. And this grew until what we call the Dark Ages. Now, we have no idea, I think, of what the Talmud meant to the Jewish people through the years and years that we're going to talk about. Because Christians tended to center their lives in the protection of the state, in their great institutions, in the churches, in solid institutional life. Jewish people had no solid life. They were pushed from one place to the other. They were dispersed. They found a home one place. They were pushed to another place. They lived in stress. They lived in constant danger. They lived in persecution. They'll live in torture. They'll live in the fear of what will tomorrow bring. They live with no protection except the hope that they might for a few years live in a place where nobody will harm them. Their haven is the Talmud. You walk through the door into the Talmud now through these years, and for a while you forget what life is like and you live in the glory and wonder of the tradition. And we have it in Fiddler on the Roof. Remember, what was the dream of Tevye? If I were a rich man, what would he do? What was his dream of having enough money so he wouldn't have to work?
Study Talmud.
That all I could just have all day to just live in the holy books. That was a haven for the Jewish people. Now, that's a little about where the Jewish community went. Just a beginning. And if you want a good way to enter into this, read Wanderings by Potok, The History of the Jews. If you don't have time to read the whole book, just start in the middle, because the first half is the part we tend to know, from Abraham to the first century. Read the second part as he goes up to the 20th century. The same writer that wrote The Promise, The Chosen, My Name is Asher Lev, writes A History of the Jews in a readable style. It reads, I think, like a novel. Now, let's go back to the Christian community and where what happened in the Christian community in the relationship to the Jews. First, even in the New Testament, we have the roots of anti-Semitism. By anti-Semitism, the despising of Jewish people. But in the New Testament, it's basically Christian Jews that are in conflict with non-Christian Jews. And that's important to remember. It was an in-family battle. So in the Gospels, you have the parable of the wicked servants, and they're the Jews that don't accept Jesus. You have the Jews saying, His blood be upon us and on our children. You have John, and it's almost embarrassing to read John's Passion Story on Good Friday, because over and over it said, the Jews did this, the Jews did that. So that's, you have these seeds of what later these passages were used in a full-blown anti-Semitism. Also, in the earliest church, there was sporadic persecution of Christians by the Jewish establishment. So you have an increasing tension, and especially the tension around this argument, is Jesus the Messiah, and also the heresy that Christian Jews were committing of eating with Gentiles, breaking the traditions of the forebears. Okay, now there's one part. Now another part of the New Testament is you have the Pauline writings that struggle with the relationship with the question of why the Jews did not accept Jesus as the Messiah, especially in Romans 9 through 11. And these are three chapters that I think through the years have been largely forgotten by the Christian church. Where in Romans 9 through 11, Paul agonizes over this question, why did not most of the Jewish people accept Jesus as the Messiah? And in this, you have the Pauline thought that the Jews are gods, are a covenant people, and the Gentiles who become Christians by faith in Christ actually are grafted into the tree of Judaism. And then Paul even says it was in God's plan that the Jews should reject Jesus. And he thinks it's because if the Jews would have accepted Jesus, they would have kept him for themselves. And so it was all part of the plan. And then finally Paul closes this section by just saying, oh, the depth of the mystery of God, how unexplainable are the ways of God. So you also had that in the Ephesians passage that was read at Vespers, how the Jews are the people who are in the family of God, and it's Christian Gentiles who are brought in late. And finally, Paul in Romans 9 through 11 says, God doesn't break the marriage vow. God married the Jews, and that is not broken. Now, these are passages that Christians have tended to forget. So early in the Christian church, it begins to happen that Christians start deciding that this is the group that we as a Christian family will hate. And you can see these seeds very early. An increasing we and them, an increasing bitterness because they rejected Jesus as the Messiah, and also the movement of the Christian church into discussing and arguing about doctrines and forgetting the teachings of Jesus about love. These are things now that happen. Now I want to show you how some of the things now that happened. One, you have to understand the argument between Christians and Jews. Each started claiming that they were the true continuation of Abraham. I mean, you have a similar situation a couple years ago in the Missouri Senate. You know, those who joined Seminex would say, we are the true continuation of Missouri. And the ones that stayed at Concordia, we are the true continuation. And I could ask Elmer, was there ever any bitterness during these years? No, everybody did it in a very friendly manner. Right, but it gives you a little idea of the bitterness and the tension that start developing. We have to go now to what really happened when Christianity became the approved religion of the Roman Empire under Constantine in the 4th century. When Christianity became fully legal and then the popular religion, the first thing now that starts happening is gradual eroding of Jewish rights, as now the government is Christian, and now the prejudices that have been building up in the church now are assumed by a government now that has power to do something about it. So the first thing after Constantine makes Christianity the approved religion, it's a crime to become a Jew by conversion. It's a crime. Then in 408 through 450, Theodosius II, these are the things that are passed. Judaism can't be offensive. think about some of the implications. There can be no conversions to Judaism. There can be no construction of synagogues. We will destroy unsafe synagogues. Can't you just hear them saying it's for their own good? We'll destroy the synagogues that we think are unsafe. And then no Jew can hold high office. No Jew can have any jurisdiction over a Christian. And then the patriarch, who was the head person of all of Judaism, that office was abolished. Now, if you follow Jewish-Christian relations, you'll see here the beginning of the erosion of the rights. So first of all, Christians will say, Jews have no rights, and we're going to move up to the 20th century where it changes to this, Jews have no right to exist. That is the movement. Now, this erosion of Jewish right continues in Europe with occasional remissions. Like I said, until Hitler finally decides they have no right to exist. Now, one thing that's handy about a merging of church and state is what the state does now. The church gladly can give a justification for it from a religious perspective. The church does a marvelous job of this in South Africa, finding all the necessary Bible passages to support apartheid. And now the church begins to give the erosion of Jewish rights theological justification. Now, it's interesting, the person that really did, we would say, the most harm, who's one of the great saints of the church, we call him St. John Chrysostom. St. John Chrysostom was a 4th century bishop of Constantinople. And now, listen to his qualifications, John Chrysostom. He was a great preacher. In fact, some say he's the greatest preacher in the history of the Christian church. He was a promoter and advocate of social justice, of care for the poor. He was against slavery and tried to abolish slavery. He believed in the equality of women. His greatest remembrance is liturgical renewal, making worship something that was alive for people. St. John Chrysostom, and the Greek Orthodox Church still uses the great liturgy of St. John Chrysostom for its every Sunday liturgy. Hey, doesn't he sound like a wonderful man? He'd be a good speaker at Holden. He could lead forums, and we would maybe say he does all the right things and says all the right things. He also invented the word deicide, that every Jew is responsible for the murder of Jesus Christ. And then he said, now notice he has one blind spot for all his goodness, and that is the hatred of Jews. He said there can be no possible atonement or forgiveness for Jews because they killed Jesus. God will hate and punish Jews until the end of the world. Now listen to that. God will hate and punish Jews until the end of the world. And then now notice how a person could take the next thing he said and just take it wherever they want. He said Christians should deport themselves accordingly. Now, he doesn't say what they should do, but he says that Jews will be hated and punished, and then Christians should act accordingly. Now, what does St. Augustine do also in the 4th century? He still reads Paul, so he does say Jews will be saved at the end of time, but he says in the meantime, Jews have a special task in history. And that is, Jews are called upon now to witness to the pain and suffering one brings upon oneself by rejecting Jesus Christ. So that is the duty of Jewish people, to suffer, to show others what will happen to you if you reject Jesus Christ. And then St. Augustine said, they must expect to be hounded by the wrath of God. Now, it isn't far to move from that into saying, well, let's help God. Right? Let's help God. So now, then, the history, then, of Christians relating to Jews just moves with things like this. 6th century, no longer a tolerated religion. 7th century, all Jews must be baptized. Now, what saved Jews at this time was a Muslim invasion. You know, when the Muslims came and invaded and detracted Christians from the persecution and the forced conversion of Jews, the Jews just said, thank God for Muslims. They're giving us a little relief. And one of the shameful things in the history of the three Abrahamic religions is how the Muslims have had much more tolerance and have been much more kind in their dealings with Jewish people through the years. Then, when the West was going through all the barbarian invasions, each Jewish community was helpless. They would bargain for their rights, they would be taxed, they would almost become slaves. And then it reached a worse at the time of the Crusades, when the crusading armies on their way to rid the Holy Land, as we'd say, of infidels would say, why don't we practice killing infidels before we get there? So the armies on their way to the Crusades would go through a Jewish section of town and commit mass murder of the Jewish populations. And then it was in the 13th century, the church council then that said every Jew in Christendom must wear distinctive dress. And now you can recognize a Jew on the street. In France, it's a yellow badge. Germany and Poland, a particularly shaped hat. And now the Jewish people daily become the target of ridicule because they have to wear certain special things. Jews then become charged with causing things like the plagues. And the word goes around that Jews are poisoning water, and that's the reason for the plagues. Therefore, you have a continuation now. 1290, they're expelled from England. And now this is the history of a Jewish community kind of gets settled. And then the Christian community changes its mind and pushes them to another place. And then they try to find another safe haven. And then that Christian community then pushes them another place. This is why Potok called his book Wanderings. There's never a place where you're expelled from one place, you move to another city, you're satisfied when you're only being mocked and you and your children are not being killed and tortured. 15th century, there's forced now conversions of Jewish people in Spain. And during the Inquisition now, people learned to report on their neighbors and look for secret Jews. You'll sit up on the top of your house, you'll get a prize if you can find a secret Jew, and you'll look, and if smoke stops coming out of a chimney on Friday night, then you report that family. Why?
That's your Sabbath.
Yeah, there's a secret Jew. At the Mass on Sunday morning, you look around to the other worshipers, and when everyone is saying the psalm, you find the people that drop out before the glory be to the Father and the Son and the Holy Spirit, and then you report them. And those people are burned then at the stake. But first, before they're burned, they're tortured in order to get them to report names of other secret Jews. And then there's stories of whole Jewish communities just being massacred by Christians, whole communities slaughtered because a Jew might be accused of murdering a Christian child. Holy Week was especially bad for Jews, and they would dread the coming of Holy Week, and especially Good Friday, because a Good Friday sermon would be a sermon to stir up the hatred of Christians against Jews for killing Jesus. And it became the tradition to rush out from the church on Good Friday, and your responsibility was to find one Jew to kill after the Good Friday service. you know, I could go on with this, but one thing that's important, that all through this there are beautiful bright spots of individual Christian people that say no to this system. One of them was a printer in Venice in the year 1520, a Christian printer. Christians had so thoroughly ransacked every Jewish home in Europe that there was a definite possibility of the Talmud actually going out of existence. And it was one Christian printer that hid the Talmud for the future of Judaism. You know, people like this should be held up as the saints through these dark days. Part of the way to feel this is to read the stories, and the source tells some stories that are very hard to read. One of them happens in Italy, and it's a story of a rabbi, Zaki. As you know, this is fiction, but it is based on the way things happen. And at a festival time there, the Christians would look for the fattest Jewish man. And then this person was a rabbi, and he was chosen that year. And then clothes would be put on him, and then in order for him to not be severely punished, he had to run around the streets of the town ahead of the prostitutes who had to try to catch him. And if they caught him, then they would not be punished. And it was so Christians could line the streets and laugh at a fat Jewish person running up and down the streets. And they would make his clothes with slits in them so the Christians could see what circumcision looked like, and they could laugh at circumcision. And then if a Jewish person, there was a Jewish bleachers that were set up so they would have to watch this disgrace and humiliation. And then any Jewish person who put his head down or her head down not to watch, there would be Christians nearby to push their head back up. And then the other yearly event that Jewish people just dreaded and dreaded was at the same festival time, all the Jews of a town would be herded into the church for their annual conversion sermon. And a preacher then would get up and devastate the Jewish religion and mock it and just spit on it, and then plead with Jewish people to become Christians. This was an annual event. Okay. Now, when Luther came along, the Jewish people hoped. And you'll see as the years go by, the Jewish people learn more and more not to put their hope on any human being who is a Christian. Because the early Martin Luther cried out against the way Jews were treated. But towards the later years of Luther's life, he became embittered against the Jews. And Luther, in a terrible tract, which I think every Lutheran should read sometime, it's called On the Jews and Their Lies, Martin Luther called for the destroying of synagogues, the seizing of all Jewish books, the law to not allow Jewish rabbis to teach, and to expel all Jews from the country. Now, fortunately, the rulers of the province where Luther was were more tolerant than Luther, and they didn't carry out his ideas. But we have to remember that later Hitler used the words of Martin Luther to fan anti-Semitism. Well, I'm almost up to the 20th century. One of the saddest things was now when, after the Reformation, 17th century, 18th century, 19th century, Jews came to think, well, maybe now with the Enlightenment, secularism, and when Christians aren't as religious anymore, maybe things will be better. But the church had taught anti-Semitism so well that when most Christians in Europe really gave up Christianity, they kept anti-Semitism. The saddest was in the end of the 19th century and early 20th century, Jewish people in Europe were saying, maybe things will be better for us if we try to act and look like we're not Jews. So Jewish people changed their names. They gave up their custom. They tried to look like Gentiles. And they say, maybe finally then things will be okay. And it was just at that time when Germany decides now Jewish people shall not have the right anymore even to exist. In this situation comes Nazism. One Christian writer on Jews, and I'm going to read this. No words are adequate either for describing or for condemning the most unimaginable crime compounded of 4 million crimes of murder. All the terrors, indignities, and tortures visited upon Jews from the days of Antiochus Epiphanes down through all the Christian centuries were added up, quadrupled, and then visited upon one generation in the Holocaust. The explicit goal was to eliminate every Jew from the human race so that there could never again be any Jews, and then to eliminate all records and relics of Jewish life so that the world would be as though there never had been any Jews. Before, you may not live among us. Now, you may not live. And I think it's important that this was more than a German conspiracy. It was a worldwide conspiracy. We know the sad stories of Americans and others not accepting Jewish refugees. We know during the war the refusal of Allied armies to bomb the rail lines that we knew were bringing the Jews to the camp. There was a sense among Jews that this was a worldwide conspiracy. Now, what do we do about this today? I think Christian life and our faith life can never be the same again after the Holocaust. How can we live without just struggling? What is the meaning of the Christian church finally teaching a nation its lesson well, so that nation decides to eliminate the very people that God married and made covenant with? Raises a question of a loving God. It takes away all our easy answers that we've said about what God is like. Any easy answer that any of us had before the Holocaust is gone. And now we live in really a post-Holocaust day when we have to raise the question of God. Robert McAfee Brown put it this way, that the Jews have this problem after the Holocaust. The world is so evil, why doesn't the Messiah come? And Christians have this problem. The Messiah has come. Why is the world so evil? That's where I'd like to just close this part. And I'm glad you came, because I believe every Christian should hear this story. And then ask our questions and pray God's guidance. You know, what do we do now when we live in a post-Holocaust world? What do we do? So I'd like to just invite any sharing. What do we do now as Christians in relationship to our Jewish neighbors and our Jewish friends?
You know, the scripture said, God has said that there will always be a remnant. Mm-hmm. And we can never permit them to be completely annihilated. So those people who say they should be annihilated are not reading the Bible.
Or they're reading the wrong words. But it was the plan of Nazism to take over really every country in the world where there are Jews, in order to annihilate every Jew from the face of the earth, and then every record of Judaism.
Well, I wonder how Martin Luther could ever arrive at that statement if he knew the Bible so well.
The big problem that Christians have had through the years is that Jesus is so precious, and the Jewish people are God's people. Why did they reject the Messiah? And this was Luther's problem, because finally, as I understand it, he was finally embittered against the Jews because he had the simple idea that the main reason they aren't becoming Christians is because the church is so corrupt. You know, and all, if we can reform the church, then the Jews will gladly come to Jesus. Well, they didn't. So Martin Luther then turned against the Jews in just poisonous anger against the Jews and wrath.
You remember the fellow, a couple of us from Germany? He had an interesting story. Jack and Ruth. They came up in the bus with us. I talked with him several times, and he had an interesting story about at least from his perspective, why Martin Luther was anti-Semitic. He said that back in the early days, I guess in Luther's time, most of the Jews then didn't have anything. And they, so they saved, scraped and saved every penny they had, and raised chickens and goats and all that, and sold them, and then made money and saved it. And of course, we all know that Jews are good business people. And they eventually amassed fortunes in Germany. And they would go to small farmers who were just barely making it and ask if they could loan the money at an interest on the interest basis. And then keep reloading money. And then when the people couldn't pay, whether they would foreclose on their property. And there were a lot of people, because of this happening, who became very bitter against the Jews. Because, and according to him, this was one of the reasons that Martin Luther was very bitter against the Jews.
I'd really want to examine that.
Of course, I don't know the basis for it, but that was his perspective.
We like to... up to the time of Martin Luther, you know, Christians were not allowed to practice usury. You know, so they did use Jewish people to do the banking. You know, but as I understand, it was more the Jewish people were being used by Christians who were making money to do what Christians weren't allowed to do according to Christian law. And unless somebody else has in my reading, I don't know of any time when the Jewish people actually gained what we call power. You know, I don't know if anybody else can help me with that. But.
Well, could it be the differences in interpretation of the Bible, or the origin of the Bible then and now also? Could that have something to do with the anti-Semitism of the Christian people of that time?
Anti-Semitism just seemed to be a big blind spot in the Christian church through the years. You know, you could talk of, like, Chrysostom is a great example. You know, women's rights, against slavery, social justice, reform of the liturgy, the role of the laity. And then this one big blind spot was hatred of Jews. And hatred isn't rational, but it just seemed to be century after century after century. This was the scapegoat. This was the hated group. This was what all your problems are blamed on. This is what you projected on. And the big question that raises for me is, what is our blind spot? It's something you just do not see unless the Holy Spirit can, you know, pound down the wall so you can see. You know, do we have a blind spot like that? Christians could feel absolutely justified in their treatment of Jews. Didn't even feel like they were being bad, they were being good. They were helping God in God's wrath against the Jews. You know, you're actually working for God by killing Jews. I kind of got off from here. But I, it's a question of that.
That same thing can apply to blacks, can apply to Indians, can apply to Norwegians and Swedes. Mm-hmm. We can very readily, easily rationalize whatever we do and not see what we're doing wrong because we feel that we're right and they're wrong.
Yeah.
But because we have the majority and they're the minority, we can build ourselves up by putting them down.
Also shows, I think, the most demonic evil is religious evil. Because you have the justification of God Almighty, and then there is no higher authority. That's, yeah, go ahead.
I think we made a mistake by calling people Christians. Christian couldn't do a thing like that. We should say they're nominal Christians. A good Christian wouldn't want to do these things that you were talking about.
Yeah.
Paul Martin Luther, a nominal Christian.
No. Why could he say something like that? At that particular time, he wasn't being a good Christian.
Yeah.
Well,
I think, you know, I think it's important that we say these were people that were baptized. These were people that, you know, went to Mass, as it was called in those days, every Sunday, and they loved Jesus. I mean, part of their hatred of the Jews is because they loved Jesus so much. You know, because they had been taught by the church that Jewish people did Jesus in, and therefore if you love Jesus, you got to punish the people that killed Jesus. I mean, we're not talking about people who were not intentional Christians. We're talking about, I mean, of course, we look back and now we say, well, of course, what they were doing is unchristian. But it isn't similar, you know, these were what they would call, at least in that day, these were fervent Christians. That's what's the hardest for me. I mean, we could excuse it somewhat if we say, well, these were all the people that weren't going to church, you know, or were just kind of nominal Christians. But, you know, that makes it very, very disturbing.
The Inquisition, they were supposed to be Christians. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Or people today who are anti-communists and want to kill the Russians. I don't call them Christian.
Kill the Nicaraguans.
Or Nicaraguans. I'd like to answer your question, what do we do? We're talking about what they did or what got here. I think we ought to get to know Jewish people. I think we ought to have friends, intimate, close friends. I think our children ought to intermarry with the Jewish people so that we stop being, you know, they and we. Mm-hmm. It was very difficult. This is really the story of my life, that two friends who befriended my dear wife very warmly when I was being stupid enough to travel all the time and letting her with the kids, they'd come help out. And she needed some help. And through them, we met a Jewish rabbi who had escaped Buchenwald. And through them, you know, a number of Jewish people who, but it was no longer anymore. I grew up anti-Semitic. My parents were mostly anti-Semitic. And always made fun of the Jews. They always put down Jewish people. As I look back in a tragic thing, I was very sorry about that. But then I could no longer do that because every time somebody said Jew, I thought of Arnie Gilbert, who's a friend of mine. He's a lovely man. A follower of God in a very deep sense of the word, and a good photographer, and whatever else you say about. Well, my answer is I think we have to build bridges into the lives and the culture of Jewish people so that we no longer sit on the outside looking at
them.
One of the problems, I think, is that sometimes people think that there's no reason to do anything, you know, that everything's fine, and it isn't. I mean, I know in college camp at Iowa, there's a lot of anti-Semitism. You know, either, and it's not religiously motivated in any sense now, but it's very much there. I mean, it's, if you want to call it cultural or scapegoatism or whatever, it's very much alive.
When One thing I've learned is that is absolutely necessary, I think, in relationship with Jewish, and this is very hard, I think, for Christian groups to hear sometime, but I think we really need to call Jewish missionary work into question. The feeling that Jewish people have is that the main reason a Christian is relating to me is to convert me. Because we have this tremendous thing in evangelism that if you convert an ordinary person, that's one thing. But if you would ever convert a Jew, it's almost like holding up the big prize. And I think there's a sense that you can find in the Pauline writing is that the Jewish people are in the hands of God. And we have a whole world to bring. And part of when we send missionaries into the world, we're really inviting people into the faith of Judaism. This is one of the most astounding things for me to realize that I am a baptized Jew. Now that as a Christian, I am an honorary Jew, and I have been brought into the family of Abraham. And if we would begin to relate to Jewish people as brothers and sisters in the faith that we both share, that comes from Abraham and Sarah, that might open some discussion. Yeah, go ahead.
Well, I'd like to supplement that. One of my highest emotional experiences was to go through the Eucharist with a completed Jew. He was both a Jewish rabbi and a priest. So he put on different hats and carry it right through. And I knew it was quite an experience.
Mm-hmm. To share the Eucharist. Yeah. That's a vision of what the whole universe will be someday. Yeah. Here and here.
Are the Jews for Jesus popular up in the Northwest?
Yeah.
That is a real mission opportunity. We had a speaker from that group, and they're really enlightening. That is a good mission field. I mean, they're, trying to reach their own. Mm-hmm. And they tell about the sacrifices they have to make by becoming Christian, and it's really kind of sad.
Yeah.
They need a lot of support.
I guess, to make where I am clear, and I don't want to, of course, everybody's not going to agree with me, but a person who is in the covenant of Judaism with God, I question our putting effort into converting that person to Christianity. I think Paul leaves us with that is in God's hands. I have personally have a lot of difficulty.
Are you saying that you don't think a true Jew can be converted?
I'm saying a true Jew. I'm asking the question.
I give the Holy Spirit a little bit more credit.
Yeah. If you could hear me, hear it from this perspective. That I'm not sure that we I'm not sure that as Christians we are ready to walk up to a Jew and say, I want you to become a Christian, until we have spent years before that Jew humbly seeking forgiveness for what Christians have done to the Jewish people through the years. For me to, I'm not saying that I would stop a Jewish person from, before the promise of the New Testament is that that in the final shalom of God, all Jewish people will be saved. Now that is a promise of the New Testament.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. I thought what you were saying was that I'm willing to say, you don't have to say that I believe Jewish people of the covenant are God's people. And do not need to know Jesus Christ to become God's people. So if we are clear, you know, if that is true, if someone believes that, then it's a whole different way of sharing Jesus Christ with them. One is to save them, which means they aren't God's people and they're going to make them God's people. And another is that they already are God's people, even prior to Jesus Christ, or even to those people who don't even know Jesus Christ. And that's a whole different way of sharing what you see as an insight, a gift, a specialty that Jesus Christ has sent. Most people in the Jews for Jesus that I know do not say that they are God's people. That only if they have Jesus Christ will they be, quote, saved. And that I would not...
Yeah, but you're talking about God's people. We're all God's people, but not...
Oh, no, chosen. No, chosen people. God's chosen people. That's what I'm saying.
Too.
Oh, no. No, well, the whole creation is God's. I didn't mean to say that. No, I mean God's people of the covenant, of the Old Testament covenant.
Aren't the Jews for Jesus, the Jews for Jesus, working among their own people?
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, that's something to remember. I mean, these are Jewish people who accept Jesus as Messiah that are seeking to convert other Jewish people.
It's not that we're trying to convert them, but
there are also a lot of Gentile groups that are, you know, missionary groups to Jewish people, too.
I read about an interesting theory by probably from Aiken Rose's wife.
Yeah.
And that he said that Jews have a special role for Christians. He said that that no one can become a Jew. The Jews are not only share an ethnic way, but they also share, you know, this covenant with God, and that they stand outside of Christianity and stand as a model for us to, and he said that Christianity is always a process of moving towards salvation, and the Jews are already saved, and that they guide us towards salvation, and that we need them more than they need us. That was kind of interesting, looking at them as a role model for us to follow and to be guided by.
See, what Christians did, I think the Pauline understanding is that the mission of the church into the world is to bring people through Jesus Christ into a covenant relationship with God, the very covenant relationship with God that the Jewish people are already in. And what Christians do, they turn that and we lump Jewish people with what we call pagans or infidels. And then they became the same as any other person in the world, the object of our missionary efforts to make them into Christians.
Well, the one thing that bothers me is if the Jews are already saved, why did God then send Jesus to the Jews, specifically?
It's
to be accepted by the Jews.
Yeah, that's exactly the question. Of course, it's a question of Christians through the ages, but it's very specifically the question that Paul wrestles with. If Jesus is a Messiah to the Jews, why did the Jews reject Jesus? And this has been the painful question to Christians through the ages, and I think we need to accept Paul's guess and then finally accept where Paul finally ends, and that's a Romans verse about the depth of the mystery of God that we'll never understand the ways of God anyway. But Paul's guess is this, and it has historical proof, and I can tell you how it's historically proved. That the mood of Paul in his answer to this seems to be that if all of the Jewish people would have accepted Jesus as Messiah, they would have smothered him. They would have made him part of Judaism, surrounded Jesus with all the Jewish cultural and ritual, and made Jesus the Messiah for the whole world into a narrowly defined Jewish Messiah. And
which is what we've done.
Yeah, but Paul's feeling was that God had to have the Jewish people reject Jesus in order for Jesus to be freed for the whole world. Therefore, it's all in God's plan, and therefore Paul says that the final destiny of the Jewish people is in God's hands. And Paul says in those passages, God does not break promises. God does not break a marriage with the people. Where the proof of this is that the earliest Christian Palestinian Jews, remember Jesus said, when they come, flee to the hills? Well, the Jewish Christians did flee. They went and formed their own little isolated communities in what is now Syria and parts of Jordan. And there they had Jesus as Messiah, and they wrapped Jesus in all of the Jewish customs and rituals and died out. And Paul finally said, if all the Jews would have said to Jesus, that's what would have happened to that God had a plan that Jesus would be for the whole world. And then the plea is, well, let God work it out with his people, or God's people, the Jews, in God's good time. And we need to... Lutherans have always studied Romans 1 through 8, and then we quit. I remember my first years in the 1 through 8 were the great... That was a great doctrinal part of Romans, and then you'd quit because then you got to the unimportant thing about Jews. You know, Christopher Stendhal, in his book Paul Among Jews and Gentiles, said those chapters are the center of the book of Romans. 1 through 8 is just Paul getting warmed up.
I have two comments.
Yeah, go ahead.
I guess the first one that occurred to me was the question as to what Christians do not do. And it seems to me that the root of the whole problem is people not accepting other people who do not think like themselves. It doesn't necessarily have to be a Jewish person. It could be anybody who doesn't have a similar feeling as you do. And I think that what the Jews would like the most from people who persecuted them is for those people to start accepting other people. Not only other Jews, but anybody who doesn't think like themselves. Mm-hmm. And I think the other thing was somebody said that people that are Christians that do this were not real Christians. I think that that reflects back on what I say is a problem with organized religion that they've had down through the ages. And that is that sometimes they get a little bit too hung up on the organization and forget what Jesus really said. The real thing, the real message was. And I think that whether or not someone was a real Christian really depends upon whether or not that person followed what Jesus said. As I understand it, Jesus taught only love. And if you're not practicing only love, then that's not practicing Christian. You go to church on Sunday, or whether you go through the rituals that the church has set up, but whether or not you practice.
So when it comes right down to it, very few of us practice love.
When you go up upon somebody with a thought of killing them, there is no love in that.
There are lesser acts of not love, though. He's had murder.
Listen, intolerance enters into our way of worship among Christians. We don't have to give people enough flexibility or respect their individuality in the way of worshiping. They don't worship the way we worship. You know, they're suspect.
A more comfortable way I have of labeling it as a Christian who sinned.
Thank you. You do.
Their sin may have been very, very major.
I think that, oh God, I'm sorry.
Well, that's
You can follow a point. I think you can follow development in the early church, though, is a movement away from talking about the teaching of Jesus to talking only about doctrines about Jesus. And we're still in this. I mean, the LCA is struggling to come up with a war and peace statement and a statement on the nuclear arms race, and it's painful to try to ever talk about the teaching of Jesus. You know, on this issue, it's interesting to me to watch that, how hard it is to just simply, not that it's simple, but what if Christians would have carried this deep respect for human life that came from the teaching of Jesus, we could have never done to the Jews what we did to them. Notice my using the word we, what we did to them. It's very important that it's my family. It's my community of faith. It's my history. If it's my history, it's still inside of me. It's still part of me.
It's interesting that you're saying that they're sitting around trying to determine what kind of stand to take in the nuclear risk. And I guess it's also my feeling that war is not necessarily something that is started by the leaders of countries, but I believe that war is started within the hearts and minds of every individual person, and that if we carry hatred on a mass scale within our own hearts, it's only natural that it's going to be carried on a much larger scale. And
the real way to start a whole new war from the world is to be sure that we have a right to our community. I think that needs to be emphasized more. And what some people call the anti-war movement, I have to call the pro-peace movement. Well, is it time? I have one little story to end with. Remember, my first parish, we had a daycare center, and we had two VISTA volunteers come and meet with their committee, and we were talking about finances. And they were both from Brooklyn, and they looked like they had just come out of a Jewish ghetto, and probably, and in the middle of the meeting, we were talking about finances, and one of the, probably the most leading person in our congregation said, let's Jew them down. Talking about some other, and then the meeting went on. Nobody said anything. After the meeting, I saw the couple out in the hall, and just they were in the glamorous mood. They were just shaken. So I asked them what was wrong, and they said, "Well, we've never really been out from our own people, and we've heard people said things like that, but we never expected to hear it." And they heard it that night. This is a subject, I think, let's close with a brief prayer. Probably. Or give us the Holy Spirit that gives us the vulnerability to say simple words like, we're sorry. We repent for what as a community, as a family, we have done through the ages that is still in our hearts. Give us a spirit of love. Help us to reach out to Jewish people. They may be friends. They may be our friends. Give us grace.